And this is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. If I had a voice like Paul Robeson, I would just retreat into a bedroom, record myself, and listen back incessantly and leave the world.
Flags are flying, rouse ye men on God relying, ne'er forget your country's story. Guard your homes and Czechish glory, guard your homes and Czechish glory. Everywhere alarm bells toll, ancient Hussite songs and soul. Everywhere alarm bells toll, ancient Hussite songs and soul. Zvorno.
That is the most magnificent basso profundo voice, the voice of the inimitable Paul Robeson, a world-famous singer and actor, a trained lawyer, an early star of American professional football, and a polyglot who spoke over a dozen languages. Yet, for Paul Robeson, the higher calling of social justice led him to abandon both the NFL and Hollywood and become one of the most important political activists of his generation. Now, scholar, historian Gerald Horn, who continuously unearths the truth of the socio-political genius and ingenuity of people of African ancestry, reveals through his biography Robeson's remarkable and revolutionary life. Gerald. Well, I love to have you on, although I have to tell you that it is with some trepidation that I fade down Paul Robeson to do so. So you're just going to have to kind of conjure up that spirit, that voice for us by telling us about Robeson's life and how it informed, aside from his acting, aside from his mellifluous voice, aside from his sports prowess and so much more, and his legal scholarship, how did this man actually inform and tell the story of the 20th century's great political struggles against racism and colonialism and for international socialism?
Well, Paul Robeson was born in New Jersey in April 1898 and died in Philadelphia in January 1976. In between, as you note, he excelled in a number of different fields. I think part of the key psychologically to unpacking Paul Robeson is understanding his family, that is to say that his mother passed away when he was a young boy, and he grew up as a motherless child, so to speak. And that, in a sense, helped to solidify further his relationship with his father, who was a man of the cloth in the AME Zion Church. And throughout his life, he oftentimes said that when he was faced with a choice or a dilemma, he oftentimes would recollect what would his father say or do with regard to the course of action that he took. He matriculated at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and he had some very disturbing experiences there with Jim Crow and racism. Even though Rutgers was and is a state university, it was not in the forefront in terms of the admission of its black student population, and Rutgers was also a school that had a football team that Robeson played on. Interestingly enough, the team oftentimes would try to sideline Robeson when it played another team that objected to competing with black athletes, at practices, he oftentimes would be attacked by his fellow classmates, that is to say, fellow athletes. And I think that this helped to toughen Robeson on the one hand and helped to give him further insight into Jim Crow on the other hand. From Rutgers, he moved on to Columbia University Law School, where he performed admirably and was on the fast track to becoming a lawyer, a middle-class lawyer of sorts. But in one of the law firms that he chose to work at, he once again was subjected to that peculiar folkway known as Jim Crow, and he diverged from the path of being a lawyer and then moved on to being a professional athlete, where he encountered similar problems. He wound up almost by accident as an artist and a performer, starring on stage and screen. And what's striking about Robeson is that his breakthrough as a performer, for the most part, took place in London, and there hangs a tale. There is a story that awaits to be told about how many black Americans in particular decided that the better part of wisdom was to try to make their way abroad. I was listening to the renowned author and raconteur Ishmael Reed from Oakland, California, on the radio the other day, and he was commenting that he was recently in Paris and was struck by the large colony of young black Americans who are now residing in Paris. And I would say historically, because of the terrible oppression that black people have faced in North America, that they have chosen to make their way abroad. And that is a story that awaits to be told in all its dimensions in terms of both journalism and history. In any case, Robeson felt that living in London was a way to escape the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow. It's not as if London was a Shangri-La, but certainly compared to his residence in New York, it seemed that way. He fundamentally lived in London from the early 1920s till about 1939, with intermittent trips back home to North America. I should also mention that while living in New York, he met and married Aswanda Good. Aswanda Good Robeson is the name which we know her, a woman of a scientific bent who remained his spouse through thick and thin up until her passing away in the mid-1960s. It was in London that Robeson made his mark as a star of stage and screen. It was in London where he helped to craft a performance of Othello, the great tragic figure of Shakespearean drama, who has withstood the test of time over the centuries. And it was also in Europe, I should say, that Robeson made a trip through Nazi Germany, then on to the Soviet Union, that transformed him politically. He was in Nazi Germany in the early stages of that regime's tenure, and it was there that he encountered the kind of racism and anti-Semitism that helped to deepen further his commitment. It was in the Soviet Union that he decided to make a stand in favor of socialism. And I should also say that what helped to influence him in that direction was his pre-existing relationship with another remarkable black lawyer, that is to say, William Lorenzo Patterson, who you may recall was the subject of another biography I published a few years ago, Black Revolutionary. And it was William Patterson who, of course, led the charge on behalf of the Scottsboro Nine, a case of racist injustice that helped to transform the Jim Crow legal system and help to knock Jim Crow down a peg or two, and also help to solidify and ratify that idea that it would take an international struggle against U.S. racism to bring it to heel, a lesson, sadly enough, that has not been fully absorbed in 2016.
Well, one of the things I just wanted to probe even further on that, there is still very much of a dichotomy amongst progressive forces here in terms of the prevalence of directing their attention to the issue of white supremacy, racial oppression, and at the class instinct and the class consideration. They're often not melded together. And one of the things that was always remarkable to me about Robeson is exactly that kind of melding, the conjuncture of race and class and his understanding of that and translating that into a system that he sought to pursue to accomplish the justice and equality. So I wonder if you can talk more about Robeson as, if you agree, that this was kind of the quintessential understanding of the hand-in-glove relationship of race and class.
Well, certainly, and it's also, if I may say so myself, part of my own personal understanding. You know that just a few months ago I published this book on the Haitian Revolution, a world historic event, for both race and class. That is to say that when the Africans on the island of Hispaniola rebelled, simultaneously they were able to advance the struggle of black people, but simultaneously they also struck a blow in favor of working class people, because with the advent of the Haitian Revolution, you saw a devastating blow inflicted upon the slave system. That is to say, a system that drove down the working standards and living standards of working people worldwide, because no worker can advance when a worker has to compete with an enslaved laborer, a truth that remains accurate to this very day. And so I think we have to understand, if we're going to make any progress, the inextricable connection, the inextricable relationship between race and class, and that's certainly embodied in the experience of African people in the Western Hemisphere and in North America more specifically, and it was certainly embodied in Robeson's own understanding, because it was also in London, where he took up the cause of the colonialism that was then the mark of oppression on the entire African continent. Colonialism was a project that not only consigned African people to be hewers of wood and drawers of water on behalf of British imperialism, French imperialism, Portuguese imperialism, etc., but it also was a terrible system of racist oppression. It was in London where Paul Robeson bonded with Jomo Kenyatta, the founding father of modern Kenya. It was in London where Robeson took up the study of African languages and mastered a number of African languages. And I should also say that it was in London where Robeson got the idea for the organization that became the Council on African Affairs, which was founded approximately in 1937 and went on to be the premier U.S.-based organization crusading on behalf of colonized Africa until it was driven out of existence by the U.S. authorities during the height of the Cold War in approximately late 1955, early 1956. It's highly possible that Robeson would have stayed in London to his dying days before the advent of World War II, which erupts in the European continent, as you know, in 1939. And it was at that point that Robeson and his family chose to cross the Atlantic and come back to the United States which was a fateful decision, because after he came back to the United States, initially he, of course, was embraced by the U.S. authorities, which, as of December 1941, too entered World War II, and therefore relied very heavily upon Paul Robeson to rally many disaffected black people to join the cause. I should say, in this context, that there was a very resonant and strong pro-Tokyo movement amongst black Americans that made many black Americans rather reluctant and loath to join the cause, that is to say, World War II, because in the run-up to December 7, 1941, Japan had curried favor amongst black Americans, including many of the leading titanic figures of black America, including Marcus Garvey, W.E.B. Du Bois, even Booker T. Washington, all to a greater or lesser degree were pro-Tokyo. Robeson helped to convince many black Americans to throw in their lot with Washington to fight Japan, and this helped to prove decisive. Robeson, of course, raised money for the U.S. bond program, which helped to fund World War II. He gave concerts from the Atlantic to the Pacific on behalf of various causes, not only in terms of U.S. soldiers, also in terms of U.S. labor. And it seemed that when World War II was concluding in September 1945, that Robeson would soar further onward and upward. But we all know that what happened was that after Washington had dispatched Berlin and Tokyo, it turned its rancor and ire on its erstwhile ally in Moscow. And that helped to launch the Red Scare and the Cold War. Robeson refused to adhere to this new political line and subsequently found himself in bad favor with the U.S. authorities that he had just helped to rescue from a military offensive spearheaded by Tokyo in particular. His passport was taken. He was not allowed to go overseas to pursue his career and to increase his income. His income, by the way, plummeted from the hefty six figures to the low four figures. He became something of a pariah, although it's fair to say that he still retained a modicum of support within the black American community, although that support did not include the leadership of the NAACP, which decided to accept the bargain that was proffered, the bargain being that in return for anti-Jim Crow concessions, the black American community, which theretofore had been a bulwark of the movement for socialism. I should mention that Robeson's other close comrade, Ben Davis Jr., a black American lawyer, was elected to the New York City Council from Harlem in 1943, reelected in 1945, before being drummed out of the city council circa 1949, perhaps illegally, and then was put on trial and thrown into a dank prison cell for violating the Smith Act. Robeson, of course, also faced many legal difficulties, although he was able to escape prison, although he was not able to escape very raucous confrontations with members of Congress, as he was hauled repeatedly before congressional committees in the late 1940s and the early 1950s and grilled as to whether or not he, in fact, was a member of the U.S. Communist Party. He said that he was not. One of the points that I make in the book is that it's highly possible that he was a member of the British Communist Party, a question that somehow escaped the attention of his inquisitors when he was hauled before congressional committees. It's also fair to say that this effort to isolate Robeson was not embraced globally or universally. I begin the book by talking about a march that's held in Johannesburg, South Africa, led by Nelson Mandela's African National Congress, where the marchers are marching to the tune of Paul Robeson's song, perhaps even the song Freedom that you opened this program with. There was a worldwide campaign that led to the U.S. authorities capitulating and returning Robeson's passport. He immediately took off for London, circa 1958, circa 1959, and would have resided in London once again, except that the illness of his wife and his own medical difficulties caused him once again to return to the United States, where he threw in his lot with the then burgeoning civil rights movement, where he was embraced by young activists from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. But alas, Robeson's health had deteriorated sharply, and by 1965, he had decided to retire from active political and professional life and remain something of a recluse until he passed away tragically in January 1976.
Dr. Horn, let me, in the time that we have left, which is not nearly enough, so people really should pick up the artist as revolutionary, one of the contributions by the prolific and remarkable historian, Dr. Gerald Horn. But round it up for us in terms of why we should reconnect with Robeson today and how his life aspirations and work really sheds light on both the conditions today of African Americans and where we should go. And unfortunately, we have a limited period of time to do it, but please help us make that connection.
Well, briefly, I would say that a principle of Africans in North America since we were dragged here in chains hundreds of years ago was to make global alliances. That has been a subject of quite a bit of my previous historical research. I argue in my Haitian Revolution book that you can't understand the abolition of slavery without understanding the role of British abolitionism and the Black Jacobins of Hispaniola. You can't understand why Jim Crow began to retreat without understanding the pressure of the Cold War and the fact that as African nations were coming to independence, they could lobby more vigorously on behalf of their brothers and sisters then in the chains of Jim Crow in North America. And one of the facts and factors that's missing from our struggle today is that international engagement, although I'm happy to say that a team from the United Nations will be coming to the United States to look into the question of police misconduct, police terrorism against communities of African descent, which helps to reinvigorate the central theme of Paul Robeson's life, which is precisely the question of how internationalism has been a stalwart factor in terms of our being able to escape the rigors and punishment and pulverizing of oppression.
Well, Dr. Horn, I want to make sure that we continue this discussion because Paul Robeson is one of the giants, and we haven't even skimmed the surface of his work in the with the United Nations, the whole issue of We Charge Genocide, and so much more to learn from him. By the way, who publishes the book so we can make sure that we all go out and get it forthwith?
Pluto Press in London.
Thank you for taking some time with us to, as always, speak with us about the profundity of the matters that you research and ferret out for us, and this, the great Paul Robeson. We've been speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, and I really urge you, it is relevant, it is readable, it is germane to where we are today and how to plow forward to deal with the reality of Black Life Matters. Thanks for speaking with us, Dr. Gerald Horn.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless
this child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long ways from home.
Paul Robeson.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash.